and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Roland Raja, and I'm the Lowy Institute's lead economist. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Ross Garnaut about his new book, Reset, Restoring Australia After the Pandemic Recession. Ross is one of Australia's foremost public intellectuals. Among his many accomplishments, he produced the 2008 Climate Change Review for the Australian Government, as well as an update in 2011. In an earlier life, he was Principal Economic Advisor to former Prime Minister Bob Hawke before serving as Australia's Ambassador to China in the late 1980s. Ross was also a founding director of the board of Lowy Institute. Currently, he is Professorial Fellow in Economics at the University of Melbourne. Ross, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Roland. Good to be back at the Lowy Institute.
Ross, you start your book by invoking the title of one of your previous books to describe Australia's pre-pandemic economy as the dog days. And you argue that if we don't do something different, we are headed for something potentially even worse after the pandemic. So just as a jumping off point for our conversation, can you give us a summary assessment of Australia's pre-pandemic economy in your view?
Yes, the pandemic brought to an end 28 years of unbroken economic growth, unbroken by recession, a longer period of continuous expansion than the Australian economy's ever had before, a longer period of unbroken expansion than any developed country's ever had before. So that was a remarkable period. But it wasn't a uniform 28 years of expansion, and I break the expansion to three periods. The first decade was the productivity boom, driven by world record-breaking productivity growth. Australia was at the top of the developed countries in productivity growth through the 90s and the first year or two of this century. After being close to the bottom for most of the 20th century, that gave us rising incomes from increased productivity. Australian incomes and economic activity kept expanding for another decade up until 2013 through the China resources boom. That was driven by the most populous country on earth, growing more strongly for longer and more resource intensively in the structure of growth than any economy had ever grown. That increased export prices for a wide range of energy materials and mineral commodities, some agricultural raw materials by 400 to 500%. That lifted Australian incomes later in the period, lifted Australian investment in the resources sector, that kept Australian incomes growing even though productivity growth wasn't growing. That's the China resources boom, roughly 2002 to 2012. After that, we didn't have a recession, but most of the growth came from immigration, expansion in the number of people. And of course, that counts as GDP growth, but doesn't count as a growth in Australian living standards. From 2013 to 2019, the dog days, over that 7 years, we had far lower growth in output per person than the average for developed countries, lower even than Japan, which we think is a poor performer economically in the past few decades, right at the bottom of the world in growth in output per person. Real household income per person didn't grow at all over 7 years. That's remarkable, probably unprecedented in history of Australia since Federation, and unusual internationally. During that period, unemployment was stuck at what I consider to be an unacceptably high level, 5 point something percent. And I spend some pages in the chapter called Wrong Way, Don't Go Back, on comparing our performance in the labour market with the United States during that period. From 2013 to 2019, Australia started that period with much lower unemployment than the US, 2 or 3 percentage points below. The US had had a deep recession through and after the global financial crisis. We didn't. We didn't have a recession because of the deftness of our fiscal and monetary expansion, and also because we were the prime beneficiaries of Chinese fiscal expansion. US unemployment started a couple of percentage points higher than Australia. US unemployment came down and down. We were just stuck at 5 point something percent, the same in 2019 as in 2013, whereas the US had gone from between 7 and 8% down to 3.5%. dramatically different performance. And during that period, our underemployment, the number of Australians who were classified as being employed, and the Bureau of Statistics classifies you as being employed if in the week before the survey you'd had an hour of work, but the proportion of Australians who didn't have, who were in work, who'd had an hour of work but wanted more hours of work grew and grew through that period. So there are all the reasons why we shouldn't want to go back to where we were. That was a period of great underperformance by our own historical standards, underperformance by international standards, given the opportunities that Australia has. We should be doing much better than that. But I do point out that if we did everything the same as we did in the dog days, we'd perform even more poorly than we did in the dog days, because a number of things are harder now. The international trade situation is harder now. We start with very low productivity growth, a lower starting point than we've had for a long time. We start with very low business investment as a share of output, but way back to levels last seen in the recession of 1991. For these and other reasons, we could end up performing even more poorly in the 2020s than in the dog days unless we did something different.
The great thing about your book is that it's full of not only analysis, but also chock full of policy recommendations for how we can avoid going back to something like the dog days and deliver what you call a restoration of the Australian economy. And so I want to try in this podcast to get through as many of your policy recommendations as possible. First, let's start with a monetary policy. So in your book, the Reserve Bank comes in for a lot of criticism. So can you just briefly explain that criticism, but more importantly also, say, where do you think monetary policy should be headed going forward?
I make the point in the book that you can get full employment simply by expanding domestic demand. Big budget deficits, big increases in government expenditure or big tax cuts, that'll get you higher employment. It'll get you to full employment if you do a lot of it, but it won't be a basis for sustainable growth in incomes unless it's accompanied by quite a lot of the employment growth coming from investment and increased output in the trade-exposed industries, for Australia especially, the export industries. And I put a big effort into explaining how full employment and sustainably rising incomes has to be based on the right level of domestic demand and the right level of growth in the trade-exposed industries. The balance between fiscal and monetary policy is crucial to getting the right balance between domestic demand and growth in the trade-exposed industries. I describe the challenge as getting to full employment with the right amount of debt. The more we rely simply on fiscal expansion, as we've done over the last year, and I'm supportive of what's done over the last year, it was the right thing to do. But if you rely only on fiscal expansion, then you won't get the growth in business investment in the trade-exposed industries and eventually output in the trade-exposed industries that will make rising incomes sustainable. What went wrong in the dog days was that we ran a combination of tight money and fiscal policy that led us to have an excessively high real exchange rate. We ran much tighter monetary policy than the rest of the developed world from 2013 to 2019, much tighter than the United States until the US unemployment went to very low levels after 2017. I've got the charts in the book that compare our monetary policy with that of the United States and compares our unemployment performance with that of the United States. And the US ran much easier monetary policy until its unemployment was much lower than Australia. That gave us an excessively high real exchange rate that killed off a lot of our potential growth in export industries, really confine export growth to the most competitive of our export industries and killed off a lot of other growth that otherwise would have been possible. And that was the essential macroeconomic policy mistake of the dog days. There's a lot of criticism of fiscal policy being too tight in the dog days. And I note that that given the monetary policy, fiscal policy was far too tight, but that if monetary policy had been closer in line with that of the rest of the world, rest of the developed world, then our fiscal policy as it was would not have been as far out of line, seeking to reduce the budget deficit as we did, would not have been as inappropriate. Also been a big change in fiscal policy, of course, abandonment of reduction of the deficit independently of the unemployment situation. We're now articulating the objective of deficit reduction very much as I suggest in Reset, not making the reduction of the deficit a prime focus of policy until employment has fallen to low levels, until we start to see the labour market tight enough for there to be growth in real wages. So I'm pretty comfortable with the changes that have happened this year, well, through the pandemic, but especially this year in both fiscal and monetary policy. And I'd say now that if we don't get to full employment with sustainably rising incomes in the 2020s, it won't mainly be because of mistakes of the Reserve Bank.
So it does seem that both monetary and fiscal policy in, as you say, targeting much, much lower unemployment, at least something in the 4% sort of range, is much more in line with what you're arguing for in Reset. But on the other hand, in your book, you also sort of, while you're arguing that monetary and fiscal policy do need to go big in terms of pushing unemployment down, you're also thinking a bit further ahead and have some concerns about how is that eventually unwound and pulled back. And one of the interesting things that you put forward is this idea that there should be an independent, what you call economic stability board, which sounds a little bit like something that has the independence of the RBA, but control over certain aspects of fiscal policy instead. You know, this is a very interesting sort of, in some ways, quite radical proposition. Can you explain a little bit further? I mean, how would you see something like this working?
Yeah, well, we have to first be clear on why we need to look at things differently. Over the past several decades, we've relied overwhelmingly on variations in monetary policy to maintain economic stability. When inflation's threatened to get out of hand, we've raised interest rates, or when we've worried that it might get out of hand, we have raised interest rates, and we've eased monetary policy, reduced interest rates when we want to boost the economy. As I say in Reset, we on average run a much tighter monetary policy than other developed countries, and much tighter than was appropriate, but the reliance was principally on monetary policy. But Reset emphasises the importance of getting the balance right between fiscal and monetary policy, amongst other things. Relying on monetary policy to reduce economic activity once boom conditions threaten to raise inflation at an accelerating rate will take up the real exchange rate. And businesses contemplating investment in the trade-exposed industries will anticipate that will happen if the institutional arrangements emphasise use of monetary policy rather than fiscal policy. The Reserve Bank was given independence over monetary policy for good reasons. Never very easy for a government, for elected officials to put the restrictions on a boom by raising interest rates, especially in the year before an election. Sometimes it's necessary in the year before an election for anti-inflationary purposes, and that's why we gave the Reserve Bank independence. But sometimes it is inappropriate to rely overwhelmingly on monetary policy. Sometimes it will be much better for the health of the economy, especially for long-term growth in incomes, to tighten fiscal policy as well as monetary policy. to avoid the real exchange rate going so high that it inhibits growth of the export industries. And for the same reasons that you needed monetary policy to be in the hands of an independent authority, you need fiscal policy in those circumstances to be in the hands of an independent authority, not the allocation of the taxation burden and allocation of expenditure amongst activities. That's very clearly right at the heart of the political process in a democratic polity. Politicians should be taking responsibility for that. But simply the macroeconomic question of raising average tax rates or reducing them alongside raising interest rates or reducing them. And if we had an independent authority looking at both, we'd have a more even balance between tightening of fiscal and monetary policy when we have to pull back a boom. If we're successful in restoring full employment or achieving full employment for the first time for several decades, for many decades, then there will come a time when we have to reduce aggregate demand. And if the business community thinks that the only tool available for that is raising interest rates, they know that that will raise the exchange rate. They know that that will reduce the profitability of export industries, and you won't get investment now in export industries, and therefore we won't have sustainable growth in investment. We'll only get employment expansion, as we've had it in the last 14 months, from increases in government-induced demand. So to get full employment with rising incomes in a sustainable way, we'd be better off if the general level of taxation could be raised or lowered as required by macroeconomic circumstances alongside the independent exercise of monetary policy.
As you say, if we are successful in getting to full employment, then that's something that we're hopefully in the lead up going to have to be thinking about much more seriously. But before we get to that, you also have in the book some more immediate sort of policy suggestions for things that should be done basically now. So let me just turn to those at this point. So first, on the tax side, you have a big suggestion here, which is to replace the current corporate tax with what you call a cash flow tax. Now, from reading the book, I can understand that this is a very complicated proposal. But can you sort of just in a nutshell tell us what would be the key difference between what you're proposing compared to what we currently have and why do we need it?
Yeah, the cash flow tax would be a much more economically efficient tax. The difference between the standard corporate income tax as it currently works is that you would allow immediate deduction of all capital expenditure. So that if a company that was generating $100 million a year in sales revenue spent $200 million on capital expenditure, then it could immediately deduct all of the capital expenditure rather than depreciating it and amortizing it over the life of the asset or over multiple years, as is the case at present. In addition to that, I'm suggesting that negative cash flows, if a company makes a loss or if it reduces cash flows below zero by very high levels of capital expenditure, it should be recompensed at the tax rate. Alongside that, I would deny any deductions for interest. They would not be justified economically if you had the immediate expensing of capital expenditure and the tax offset for negative cash flows. And I'm also suggesting denying deductions for imported services unless the expenditure is directly related to the provision of services to taxpayers. The combination of these things would shift the balance of the taxation burden away from companies that are investing, away from companies that are taking a risk, because at the moment, the tax system favours those who are not taking a risk.
You've also got a big proposal on the spending side in terms of what I think a lot of other people would call a universal basic income, but what you're calling an Australian income security system. So can I just ask you to explain how would your sort of approach to this work? And I guess the key question is, can we, you know, really afford to have a meaningful universal basic income?
Well, that proposal, I call it Australian Income Security because I don't want to call either of its common names, because each has got a lot of political associations. It's the same concept as the negative income tax, which was favoured by Milton Friedman and Rose Friedman in their book Free to Choose half a century ago, and which was a favourite of the free market right wing of American politics for quite a while, as a way of removing the disincentives to employment that are associated with standard Social Security, which is withdrawn, introducing high marginal effective tax rates. In, as you say, in Australia, it's been more commonly called a minimum basic income or variations on that name. And that's generally favoured by Australians who want a greater emphasis on equity. I make the point that Australian Income Security doesn't have a political colour. It's simply a more efficient way of providing Social Security payments while minimising disincentives for participation in the labour force. It's not left or right. It's not Milton Friedman or Brian Howe. It's just a more efficient way of achieving the objectives of both left and right. The centrepiece of the reform is to integrate the tax and social security systems. At the moment, you get a tax-free threshold up to nearly $20,000. At the moment, if you earn social security, you can do a little bit of work before you start losing your social security, and then you lose a lot. And then before your income is anywhere near the full-time employment of an unskilled worker, you're losing most of your extra income, sometimes all of your extra income, through withdrawal of Social Security and payment of income tax. That's a very substantial disincentive to work. And the integration of the tax and Social Security systems with a moderate tax rate, starting with the very first dollar. You won't have a tax-free threshold, but the very first dollar of income will be taxed at. And I try out two rates, 32.5%, which is in the process of becoming the basic tax rate for most Australians under the current government's policies. I initially was looking at 37%, which would be less expensive, although the difference in the expense is, at least at introduction, is not so great, as the government reduces general tax rates. My back of the envelope arithmetic suggests a large initial cost could be several tens of billions of dollars per annum. But we would get most of that back if my assessments of increased labour force participation are correct. That is something that requires analysis. I noticed that Mike Keating, in the former Secretary for Finance and former head of the Prime Minister's Department, in a thoughtful review of my book, in which he agreed with everything except this, said that it would be too expensive because he didn't think you'd get much increase in labour force participation. I think that's wrong, but this is a question that we should focus on. How much it will cost depends on how big an increase in labour force participation we'll get. I think it would be a big incentive for people currently on Social Security to enter the labour market.
I want to bring you to climate change, which is something you've obviously worked on for a long time now, and is obviously a focus in the book as well. Of course, this is something that you tend to always talk about, but in the context of what you call restoration, what's the role that climate change policy and decarbonisation of the Australian economy? What's the role there in terms of how Australia recovers from the pandemic?
Well, in the book Superpower that I did the Sydney launch of at Lowy Institute, and saw you there, Roland, at the end of 2019, I pointed out that in a zero emissions world economy, Australia has many advantages. So we are naturally the low energy cost developed country in that world, and renewable energy is overwhelmingly capital And if you're the lowest cost developed country, you'll be the lowest cost country in the zero emissions world for energy. And that makes Australia the natural locus of processing, first of all, of Australian minerals and raw materials. So we've got advantages in the zero emissions world economy that we don't have in the fossil energy economy. We've got the lowest cost wind and solar combinations in the developed world. We've also got the lowest cost metallurgical coal. But we don't get an industry advantage from metallurgical coal. It's just as cheap to use it in Shanghai or Kobe as in Whyalla or Port Kembla. But that won't be the case with the zero emissions economy. You can transport Australian renewable energy to Singapore or Japan, either through a high voltage direct current transmission cable or through hydrogen or one of the hydrogen carriers made from renewable energy and turned back into zero emissions energy in those places. But it'll be very expensive, probably three times as expensive in Kobe or Shanghai or Singapore or, for that matter, Germany, as it is in Australian industrial cities, whereas the price of metallurgical coal is much the same its export destinations as it is in Australia. So it'll give a huge economic advantage to Australian minerals processing. Similarly, aluminium, we're by far the world's biggest exporter of iron oxide for producing iron metal and steel, by far the world's biggest exporter of aluminium oxide for producing aluminium metal. Aluminium, you simply turn from aluminium oxide into metal with electricity. If it's in the zero emissions world economy, it'll need to be renewable electricity. That'll be done very much more cheaply in Australia than anywhere else in the world. So if economics runs the story, then we'll be the big exporter of iron metal and aluminium in the world. Another big advantage is that we've got far more opportunity for sequestering carbon in our landscapes and growing biomass than other countries. Got far more woodland per person than any other developed countries, and developed countries have got a lot more than developing countries. That's going to be very valuable, both as a source of negative emissions, which can be sold on world markets to balance processes where emissions can't be cheaply removed, but also biomass will be used as a raw material for plastics and petrochemicals in place of coal and gas, and we've got far more opportunity for growing that without competition with food than other developed countries. So these are huge export opportunities. They've become better opportunities since the publication of my book, Superpower, because the rest of the world really has got on to the story of commitment to zero emissions world economy. The big change, of course, is Biden's election in the United States, committed to zero emissions in electricity by 2035, zero emissions in everything by the middle of the century. Committed not only to that, but in the United States, but to making sure the rest of the world gets on board. And Biden has made it clear that the primary international policy objective of his administration is to secure strong outcomes on global reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. In this, Biden has joined all other developed countries and China to zero emissions by around mid-century. All other developed countries, except at this stage, Australia. And that is a great world for Australia if we really embrace the future, because we've got great export opportunities. That's tremendously important for restoration of Australia after the pandemic recession, because for full employment with rising incomes to be sustainable, we're going to need faster growth in exports than we've got of total output. We can't simply achieve full employment by expanding government expenditure as we have over the last 14 months. It won't be associated with rising incomes unless we can add strong growth in the export industries. Big headwinds against growth in the exports that were important before the pandemic. 22% of our exports are coal and gas. They won't be growing as the world heads towards zero emissions. In fact, they'll be falling away. We have crippled the financial base of our universities, and the universities through exports of education services were the most dynamic part of our export story in the dog days. They won't be contributing positively after the pandemic recession, unlike high-priority service export industries like casinos. The universities were denied the emergency support of JobKeeper. So the universities that have been crippled financially and won't be in a position to grow strongly in export services once movement of people has been restored. The third big headwind is the relationship with China, where we've been cut out of a lot of the high-value export growth opportunities. And I take that as given in the book when one can analyse how we got into that position, but we're there, and that's not going to change very quickly. So that our prospects are rather dim unless we find new sources of export growth. But just at this time in history, they are there through a combination of our strengths in the zero emissions economy and the strength and commitment of international movement towards zero emissions following the election of the Biden government.
Mm. Are these viable in the near future, though? I mean, we talk about, green steel, green hydrogen. I mean, can these contribute in the next couple of years to restoration, or is this still a more medium-term view?
Well, some things are highly viable now. In fact, take aluminium. Our aluminium processing can be globally competitive. We move quickly to zero emissions. It's not competitive with coal. Currently, we've got large aluminium smelters in Gladstone in Queensland, Tomago in New South Wales, Portland in Victoria. They will all be dead sometime in the 2020s if we continue to rely on coal. They're too expensive, and the owners of those businesses, Rio Tinto and Alcoa, are committed themselves to movement towards zero emissions. So two strikes against them, both of them deadly strikes. No future for those smelters if we continue to rely on coal. On the other hand, right now, we could make them globally competitive through shifting to renewable energy. Something similar could be said for a number of other commodities. One of the big growth commodities is silicon, of course, the essential ingredient in computers and photovoltaic panels, which are both growing very strongly. We've only got one plant making silicon, actually very high-quality silicon, big international demand, but only about 1% of global supply. That's based in the southwest of West Australia. Right now, we are the natural place to turn sand or quartz, and we've got plenty of that, into high-quality pure silicon with large amounts of energy. Green steel, while using hydrogen, is not right now directly competitive, except as developed countries elsewhere insist on falling emissions and zero emissions. It's certainly competitive now if Europe insists on decarbonisation at home and imposes border taxes. That would make border taxes on steel made from coal. That would make Australian green iron competitive right now. How quickly will it become competitive even in places that don't put a penalty on carbon-intensive steel? Well, that depends on the rate of technological improvement. And we know from the experience with solar and wind and batteries that the rate of technological improvement depends on the rate of deployment of the new technologies. There's no doubt that zero emissions steel through the hydrogen route, using renewable energy to make hydrogen, will be competitive. It will become competitive through the scale of production of electrolyzers being large enough for long enough. The costs of electrolyzers will fall with scale of application, just as costs have fallen for solar and wind and batteries as more and more have been introduced. Many other countries are currently, with good economic reason, introducing subsidies for use of these new technologies. It's economically justifiable to support innovation in a new technology because the innovator brings down the costs of everyone else by teaching them lots. And the German government, the French government, Scandinavian governments, under the Biden policies, the US government are introducing strong support for zero emissions industry. And that brings costs into line much earlier. And then deployment of the new technologies through these various means will bring the cost down on a sustainable basis. That's exactly what happened to solar photovoltaic. It was the European policies that required use of solar and provided strong incentives for use of solar earlier in this century that gave the solar photovoltaic industry the scale and the learning that brought costs down and made it competitive. Something similar will happen to electrolyzers. That will be done in other countries. Australia could just wait and watch industries develop in other countries, or we could be part of that development of the new technology that's so advantageous to Australia. If we're part of it, we'd start to do it now, start to get business investment now. We'd also start to get investment in the supporting electricity transmission and renewable energy production. So it's up to us, really. The rest of the world will be paving the way for us. The risk, of course, if we wait and leave it to Germany and Sweden and Norway and France and Japan and the United States, is that they will get their costs down before we do and we'll be locked out. That's one of the risks we face if we don't embrace the movement to zero emissions early on.
Well, Ross, this has been a fascinating conversation. Let me thank you again for joining us on the podcast to talk about your excellent new book. And I do hope to have you here at the Institute again sometime in the near future.
Okay, always good to be in touch with the Institute, and all the best.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute hosted by Institute experts with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhart. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us for the next episode of Lowy Institute Conversations.